it's Stevie GB, comedian from Long Island, and you could see me on August 25th tonight in Port Jefferson, and all fall long around Long Island. And I'm on with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, my friends. Shalom, my enemies. This is your old pal, Rabbi Saul Solomon, founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am from Long Island, and I am delighted to talk to another Long Islander right now. Not only that, you know, every time I go see my accountant, I start to cry. But this is an accountant who will make us laugh because he is, and has been voted, the world's funniest accountant. His name is Steve Gianturco, or much better known as Stevie GB. He has been a stand-up comedian for 25 years now. He's opened for people like Dennis Miller and Uncle Floyd and Lisa Lampanelli and Louis Anderson. He's written plays. He's had them done off Broadway, including shows like Welcome to Long Island, You Bet It's Groucho, and of course the unforgettable Vampires Suck, the musical. You can go see Stevie GB live and in the flesh and full of blood tonight, Saturday, August 25th, at Theater 3 in Port Jefferson. He's on the main stage, in fact. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado or a don't, please welcome to the neighborhood, Stevie GB. Shalom, Stevie.
Hello, shalom, Rabbi. How are you?
I usual aches and pains, the prostate, the back, the sinuses. What about you? You're getting up there a little bit. How are you feeling?
I just hit that magical number of 60, so I know how I know your pain. I feel it.
Oh, the big 6-0, one step away from death. Are you? I mean, you have to be physically active up on the stage there. Is it easier, harder, or do you feel like you did when you were 30?
I feel like I did when I was 29.
Oh, there you go.
I do. I feel good. It doesn't bother me. Only in the morning. The only time I can't pee is when I have to.
I know what you're talking about. But are you still a certified public accountant?
Well, yes. Technically, I only work part-time now. I'm semi-retired. But I've pretty much embezzled enough money now to be able to get out of the accounting business.
Very nice.
Yeah, thank you.
And this is why you're not my accountant, but yes, sorry.
Try to get into more of the comedy side of things, so.
25 years you've been at this. Roll it back to, like, 1990, just before you started doing. What was the impetus?
What got me started?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I've been funny my whole life, I think. My parents were funny. I remember, I think my earliest memory was being about 8 years old, and my mother sat me down in front of the TV and said, "Watch this." And it was Duck Soup by the Marx Brothers.
Yes.
And I think that was the beginning when I, you know, when you see your parents laugh, you kind of get a good connection as to what it's all about. So I learned to be funny at an early age, and I was always the funniest guy in school, the funniest guy in the office. And on a dare, somebody dared me at an office job to enter a talent contest at a local restaurant that was looking for comedians and musicians and whatnot. And she said, "Try comedy." And I said, "Okay." So I did it, and that was it.
I bet you remember that moment, that first time you hit the stage. Do you remember any of the material that you came up with for that
first?
No,
the funny thing, I sort of do. Some of it I still sort of do.
Ooh.
And other, I had 15 minutes, which at the time I didn't know that 15 minutes is like a lifetime.
Yeah.
To start out in comedy. But I did the full 15 minutes. And not only that, but I won third place in the contest and went home with a Bonnie Raitt cassette and a T-shirt. So.
Actually, second place would have been 3 Bonnie Raitt cassettes, but you know.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, no, exactly. But the material, let me think. The only joke I still sort of do that I did, that I wrote, that I actually wrote, was I was in the library recently and I saw a book there called Final Exit, which is a book about how to commit suicide, written by a doctor. And it's in the library. And my first thought is, this book's going to be overdue.
You know, that still works. That is
a funny joke.
It is. Well done. Well done.
Yes.
So once you got that taste, and once you listened to the Bonnie Raitt cassette a time or two, when was the next time that you said, "Oh, I'm going to try this again"?
Well, as soon as I got off stage, I figured I was going to be a famous comedian immediately. But I could probably, you know, be on Letterman in a couple of weeks. And, you know, you get that delusional germ immediately. And, you know, I went to the local comedy club and found out that they actually have open mic nights. And I went to McGuire's in Bohemia and I signed up. And, you know, in the beginning it was all easy because I was able to bring in a lot of people that I knew, and friends and family were coming to see me, and then once you burn them out, it becomes harder to get stage time. So,
well, let me ask.
It only lasted maybe 6 months or 7 months, and then I quit for a couple of years. But then I went back to it because it was a bug that I wanted to taste again, and then I never stopped.
Did you have early on in the process, did you have maybe not a hell night where you're dealing with drunk people and hecklers, but just a night where all the material that had been working just great bombed like crazy?
Of course.
Why?
Of course.
Why does that happen? What is that?
I don't know. You know what I think it is? I think not everybody likes comedy. I figured this out. It's like if you go to a party and somebody decides to bring somebody in to do rap music, there's going to be a portion of that audience that's not going to enjoy it. And even though the jokes may seem funny to some people, other people just don't understand comedy and they don't like it. And
well, what are they doing in a comedy club?
I don't know. They got free tickets? Or I'm talking about when you do a real hell gig, like a backyard party or a private function. Those are much harder. Because I always say this, it's easier to bring the people to the comedy than bring the comedy to the people.
Well, yeah, because if you have a space that's designed for it, a little dark black or basement wall, just really stark and a little bit dank and cozy, that is more conducive than some fancy place or like a sunlight and stuff.
No. Right.
So you got back to it after giving it up. And you haven't stopped, really, since then?
No, I haven't. I mean, I've done other things in between, but I've always kind of had to stand up on the side.
Now, you were doing, you say now you're easing towards retirement, you're part-time accounting, but for the first, I would say, what, 20 years, you still kept a full-time accounting job? How did you manage?
Well, comedy is at night and weekends, so that was the easy way to manage it.
Yeah, but comedy is like open mic at 12:30 at night and then not getting home until 3. How do you function?
Well, I tried to avoid those as much as possible. You know, the open mics were usually on an off night, like a Wednesday night or a Thursday night. I would do the ones that were closer to home, that I didn't have to travel so far. And on the weekends, you know, maybe I would do a Sunday or a Saturday, try to get into the city and get on some stages. But, you know, it's very competitive.
And also, you want to move up in the biz, basically.
Yeah.
If you're lucky enough to get an agent, you have to drive hundreds and hundreds of miles and stay in shit hotel rooms, pardon my French. But I mean, you did not want to, and nor did you do that.
I did. And actually, in probably 12 years ago now, about 2007 or 2006 or so, I did do some road gigs. I had a job where it was more of a consulting job, so I had the ability to make my own hours.
Mm.
So I decided, let me try to do some road gigs. And I actually did. For about a year and a half, I went to Jersey and Pennsylvania and Ohio and upstate, and I did exactly what you described, stayed in the crappy hotel rooms or the condos with other comedians and did the week-long gigs for shitty money, and it was awful because I had this delusion that going on the road meant it was more of a glorious thing. It's just driving further for another crappy gig.
But did it in the long run help? Certainly, just by performing, you get better and better and more skilled and more able to handle audiences. But in terms of profile and career, was it worth it?
I think it helps. I think stage time, like you said, stage time is stage time. The more you get on stage, the better you get anyway. It doesn't really matter. You don't have to drive 300 miles to get better. It does help because it makes you feel a little more legitimate, like, oh, I'm a real comic now, I'm driving somewhere, rather than just doing the same local haunts. So it was fun in that respect. It's just that, you know, to drive so far, it's about a half an hour of fun, 30 minutes on stage if you're lucky, or less.
Yeah, 30 is
the rest of it is just brutal, horrible nonsense between the traveling and the waiting and the sitting. And
do you have any particularly either funny or wretched anecdotes from that year and a half on the road?
Well, I think that the worst one was when I drove up to Rochester. I drove up there and I went to a club that was, it was a week long. It was a Wednesday through a Sunday. It was seven shows. And I stayed in a comedy condo, which was a disaster. I was the opening act. There was a MC, opener, feature, and the headliner.
Yeah.
The MC came up, did his thing. I came up, and they decided that that was the perfect time to start taking orders and serving dinner.
So
every single show, I had to compete with people saying, yeah, I'll have the chicken wings and the mashed potatoes. And the... So nobody was paying attention to me, every single show. And the headliner was nice enough to tell the booker that I didn't do well.
Come on, name names.
Nice
who was,
of him.
Who was the headliner?
You know, I would love to remember his name just to be mean. It was David something. It wasn't David, your friend there. David.
Wasn't David Steinberg?
I don't remember his last name, and I've never seen him since. So thankfully, he got his. I think karma worked in my favor in that. After that trip.
Now, were there any people that you were traveling around with or being in the comedy condo with who that we were nobodies then and they later got a sitcom or they're known on the circuit now and are pretty well known?
You know, believe it or not, I think just about everybody I traveled with are either still bouncing around doing the same thing. Nobody that I could say, hey, I was with Kevin James or
right.
No.
Well, I think you missed the big, like, the 1980s boom.
Yeah.
You were 10 years too late on that, I think. No offense.
I was late on that.
But now, I mean, you've got a lot of gigs. You're appearing somewhere pretty much every week. As a matter of fact, people, of course, can see you tonight at Theater 3 in Port Jefferson. You've got a gig on September 14th at Governor's.
Yes.
In Levittown. I mean, at Governor's, for gosh sakes. And then someplace I've never heard of called Little Bit O' Heaven.
Yeah.
In Northport on September 21st. What the? Is that a comedy club or is it a sex
place? Well, it's a Christian coffee house that welcomes all denominations. It's not just Christians. And it's really nice. She has a nice stage there and she has bands and she has squeaky clean comedy night.
Oh, wait a minute. I'm going to stop you right there. Because this is the one thing I almost did not want to talk to you. I have to say this. I almost scorched this whole interview because there's a clip of you on YouTube that is quite amusing. It's you doing your stand-up comedy. But you're standing on like a lectern, a dais, in front of a Jewish star.
Right.
And it's on a fucking cross.
I know.
What is that?
That's Samantha's Little Bit of Heaven because she's Jewish. But she has this place, and she's trying to welcome everybody, but some people are a little turned off by that.
That's a fucked up logo, right? Because I'm thinking, oh my God, you're at a Jews for Jesus temple.
Yeah, it feels that way.
But it's not. It's just multi-denominational.
Right.
Maybe if they could tell her she should put like a crescent moon and a star thing on there, so if you include the Muslims, everybody will get it. It's like, oh, it was for everybody.
Yeah.
Right now it looks like Jews for Jesus, whom I despise and want to kill. But anyway.
Yeah.
Now you, the funny thing is, you have your inflection, you have a Larry David sort of a voice.
Oh. I hear that a lot.
People just heard you.
Pretty good.
There you go. People would think you were Jewish. But you're John Tortorella.
Oh, it's true. I am not. I'm actually half Greek, half Italian. I look Jewish. I always say my mother was very close with Saul Greenberg, CPA, so I'm starting to wonder.
and you're an accountant. I don't know how you wound up.
I'm an accountant.
Yeah.
I grew up in Brooklyn. Well, the thing is, I grew up in Brooklyn, and all of my I was Greek Orthodox, so I didn't go to Catholic school. So all the kids in my neighborhood who were Catholic went to Catholic school. I went to public school with all the Jewish kids. Now, so my friends were like Norman Weissman and Perry Rosen and Morris Griesman. These are real names. So I think I must have inherited, plus I said before, watching the Marx Brothers, and I grew up with Jewish comedy. I mean,
as well, you should have. And I'm sorry I cut you off because it sounded real. Do that pretty, pretty good thing that Larry David does.
Pretty, 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 pretty good.
You do. It's really. Are you ever asked to mimic him or do stuff like that?
Well, it's funny on stage. Like, I do a joke that I do a Bernie Sanders impersonation. Bernie Sanders sounds like Larry David. So I do like a, you know, we're in this together. And then I say, well, it's more like Larry David imitating Bernie Sanders imitating Larry David. And then people catch on that, oh, yeah, he sounds like Larry David. But I hear that a lot.
Now,
I don't know why. I don't. This is my natural voice. I guess that's his natural voice, but we do. A funny thing is one day I was watching Curb Your Enthusiasm, and my wife was upstairs, and she yelled downstairs, who are you talking to?
Wow.
Me, on the phone, and it was Larry.
Excellent. Excellent.
I said Richard Lewis.
So Ted Danson is on the phone for you, yeah.
Ted Danson.
We're talking with Stevie Chibino. Stevie, you do play, as we said, you're going to be at this place, Little Big of Heaven in Northport on September 21st, which does squeaky clean comedy. Are you always squeaky clean, or just for that venue?
Well, you know, it depends. What I do is I like to advertise myself as a clean comedian because it gets me more gigs, you know, corporate gigs. Mm. They're always very nervous to hire comedians because they think someone's going to get insulted, someone's going to call a lawyer, you know, so they want to make sure, are you clean? So I can be dirty. I write clean, and if I have to, I throw in an F-bomb and I throw in something that spices it up a little bit. But I would say 90% of the time I could be clean.
Okay. I would say maybe 20% of the time I'm clean. Rest of the time I'm... and I'm just talking about showering. But anywho...
Oh.
So let's talk about some of the people that you have opened for.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to people have opened for Bill Cosby. That's a very different thing. But let's talk about, let's say, Dennis Miller. You opened for him at one point. Where was that?
That was at the Paramount in Huntington, which is a beautiful venue. It holds about, I'd say, 1,500 people, and it's mostly a concert hall, but they do have a comedy series where they bring in pretty big headliners,
yeah.
Dennis Miller, for example. And I'm fortunate enough, the Long Island Comedy Festival, which is Paul Anthony, which is the guy I work for at Theater 3, he books those shows. He also books the comedy series at the Paramount. So he'll call me and say, hey, are you available? And usually, again, I get those kind of gigs because they're looking for a clean comedian. Dennis Miller's going to be there. He wants somebody clean to open up for him. And unfortunately for me, it's a short list. He only has like five or six clean comics. So I get those kind of gigs. I just work out and I get them.
It sounded like you said unfortunately for you, but fortunately for you.
Fortunately.
Yeah.
I said unfortunately, and then I said, really, unfortunately for the other comedians, fortunately for me.
Well, when you open for some of these bigger names that we mentioned before, do you get to meet them, or literally
Yes. They're
doing... Oh, so what was Dennis Miller like?
Oh, he said everybody that I've opened for has been nice. They're all
Yes. Nice
people. You know, they're not going to act like, you know, morons in front of me. They take a picture, they say, hello, how are you? I don't get to go out to dinner with them. I don't really talk a lot. Usually they're surrounded by other people, like people who come to see them are friends of theirs, and they come backstage and they talk to them. So I try to remain professional because I know I'm the opening guy. I'm not...
It's incumbent on you to be nice and professional, but sometimes, you know, you get the jerks again. But it's nice to know that, at least to this point in your experience... the bigger names that you've opened for were very cool.
Every single one of them. I have not had an issue with any of them.
That's why. Now, who is the funniest comedian you've ever seen?
Well, I'm a big fan of Bobby Collins.
You opened for him?
8 times.
Whoa.
And the funny story, you know Bobby?
Not personally, but I know who, him as a comedian, yeah. You know him personally.
He is like the comedian's comedian. He hasn't reached the level that he should have, and I don't understand why, because he's been around at least 35 years. But the thing I love about him is he's just a great guy off stage, and he's so funny on stage. He really, truly makes me laugh. I mean, I think he's terrific. I liked everybody. I mean, Bobcat Goldthwait was very fun. I enjoyed his set.
Yeah. I mean, he's still alive, he's still doing stand-up as well as directing. I mean, he's still out there.
Yeah, well, he doesn't do a lot of stand-up. He did like one little short tour, and then he seemed to... He's one of these guys that comes around, and then he disappears for a few years.
Yeah. Well, he's got better things to do. He's making music videos and movies.
Movies, and yeah. He was an odd person. He was exactly what you'd expect him to be, but he was very cool, and I thought his set was really, really good.
So wait, did you open for him? It sounds like
yes.
I didn't see him on. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I didn't have him on the list. I should have.
Or I forgot. I didn't list all the names. I was writing them in Hebrew, so it takes time.
I don't know what Goldthwait is in Hebrew. It's probably Goldberg.
Goldthwaitowicz. Yeah, pretty much. But actually, when you see him being a normal person, it's not what you expect. Because people remember him
exactly.
as a wild man. And, of course, he's this deep-thinking, kind of goateed, normal person, you know, obviously.
Right. No, he was a very intelligent guy. I enjoyed... I spent more time with him than probably the other openers, the other closers. A lot of them, what happens is, like, if the show starts at 8, they tend to show up at 5 to 8. You know, that's what I didn't notice. They don't really get there that early. They just kind of show up. So I don't really have a lot of time to BS around. But with Bobcat, he was there when I got there at 7. So it was nice, a good long hour or so to kind of hang out and chat with him. And
did he give you any tips or any advice or any...
Yeah, you know, there's really nothing they could say that I haven't heard from everybody. It's the same thing. It's just keep writing. Keep getting the stage time and just keep doing it and don't give up. You know, it's the same old...
Well, actually, what is your method? What is your problem? Is like, are you struck with an idea and then you'll take 10 minutes and write it on a pad and then rehearse it and work it out? Or do you set aside writing time every day or every other day? What do you do?
Oh, no.
No, what?
I tend to get creative surges. Like, all of a sudden, yeah. I'll have like a whole couple of days where just ideas pop into my head. And now, with the beauty of technology, I just write it in my phone. I'll write a couple little buzzwords, and then I kind of, like, practice it in my head while I'm walking around or while I'm doing stuff. I'm like, I think about the bit in my head, and then I never really write it down until, like, the day I'm going to do it. That's when I kind of write down longhand on a pad exactly how I want the joke to work. And by the time I actually get on stage to do it, it's already been, like, through the mill a bunch of times.
No, and also let me ask, it's one thing when you're doing a 10 or 20-minute gig, and you're doing a couple of jokes and setups and things, but when you're doing half an hour, 45 minutes, do you have a cheat sheet? Do you have notes? Because I always wonder about comedians who are up there for an hour or so and just fly and joke after joke and piece after piece without even a list, or maybe they've just got it hidden somewhere.
Well, yeah, I've seen both of those things. I don't go on stage with a list because it'll throw off my timing and it'll be distracting and I'll feel compelled to keep looking at it. The way I write is in categories. Like, I only have, like, 5 or 6 categories that fit my whole set. So every time I write a new joke, I figure out what category does that fit in. So I'm kind of writing sideways. I'm not adding to the list. I'm adding to the category. So when I go up there, I know, you know, married, 60, accountant, you know, I know Long Island.
Right.
I know my topics, and I just add to that topic. So it kind of, that's how I build from like 15 minutes to 30 minutes to 40 minutes. And if I'm hired to only do 15 minutes, I know I can still do the same topics. I'm just not doing the branches of that specific area. I'm just cutting, I'm editing the topic. So my set list is pretty much the same all the time. It's just longer when I have more time.
No, I totally get that. And probably 25 years ago, you were doing more about being a Brooklyn kid going moving to Long Island. Now it's more about middle age to aging to accounting.
Right. I always try to stay present. One thing I don't like that a lot of comedians do in my age range is they love to talk about the old days. When I was a kid, and my father did this, and my mother was... You know, it's like it's starting to feel a little... overdone. They're all doing the same thing. I would rather go up there and talk about what's happening to me right now. You know, I'm 60 and this is that. My wife, it's just me and my wife. My daughter moved to Florida. Now it's just me and my wife. It's the empty nest thing. You know, it's what's happening to me right. Like, this is my life now. If I had to come up with a tagline, that's what I like. Because I want to talk about, who cares what happened 40 years ago? We know about that. I want to talk about what's happening now.
Well, what is happening in your life now? I mean, we know you do the stand-up, you do the still part-time work, and you've been married for how many years?
36 years.
Well, double high, if you know what that means. 2 times 18, double chai. So what is your secret?
I love saying this because somebody said this to me once. And I was on stage and I asked the guy in the audience, how long are you married? He said, 42 years. And I said, what's the secret to being married that long? And he said the greatest line I ever heard. He said, it's still a secret.
Oh, that's very good, actually. And now you can steal that.
You know what the secret is? I'm going to tell you right now. Here's the thing. When you're first married, you argue about every little thing, right? You left the cap off the toothpaste. You forgot to lock the door. You fight back and forth. Eventually, your battles get less and less. Then you fight about the big stuff. Now we're at a point where we just watch TV. That's all we do.
I know.
Television.
It's so true.
There's no more food. We don't fight. What's the point? I'm not going to win any fights. I've lost every fight. I'm not going to win. So I don't start.
And of course, the ultimate loss is that the wife, my dear wife, Miriam Libby, when you're watching TV, she controls the remote. Hour after hour after
hour. You just go in losing. You don't want to start a fight you're going to lose. Just go in and just assume that you're going to lose, so just don't start.
But now, think about it. You've got your empty nest. You're cutting back on your hours. Is this another time where you might take a wider shot and do maybe West Coast or things like that? Or are you just comfortable staying in New York, Long Island, Jersey?
Well, you know, I struggle with that. It's funny you say that, because I do struggle with that. A part of me wants to live that dream of, you know, just driving out west and getting any gig I can get and, you know, get an RV and live in the RV and do the Jewel thing. Jewel, like, who lived in a car from Alaska or whatever. I mean...
And well, she looks like Jewel. You do not look like Jewel, so she
doesn't look like Jewel at all.
Yeah.
No, that's her big thing was she lived. I think she lived in a car for 2 weeks, but she milked that story for 20
course.
Years.
Yeah. And can you yodel? Are you a yodeler?
I am not a yodeler. No. I'm more of a ding dong. I'm more of a
ring.
There you go. But I'm bump. But you know, a part of me wants to do that. Like let's just throw caution to the wind. But you know, I don't know. Then a bigger part of me says, I'll just stay local. I'm getting the good gigs. I'm happy. I'm writing. See, that's the thing. I would rather stay here and just write a new show, just write and create another one-man show. I like to do one-man shows and just do it at my local places that know me, that people that will come and see me because they like me and they've seen me before, and now I got something new to talk about.
Well, let me ask you this, because one of the guests on this program a couple of years ago was Frank Ferrante, who is best known for doing a one-man show about Groucho Marx. You have done your own. I assume you've seen his at some point. So how is your Groucho Marx show different or special?
Well, it's funny, because I've been wrestling with the idea of doing a Groucho Marx, because I'm a huge fan, for years. And he had that play, A Life in Review, which was written by Groucho's son, Arthur. And I loved the play, and I watched Frank Ferrante do it. I didn't see him live, but I saw him do it. And I was like, if I dare say this, I was not that impressed with his performance. It felt too flashy. It was too Broadway, I think. And I said, you know, I don't think he really got the real essence of Groucho. And then I thought, if he could do that, I could do that, and I think I could do it better. And I didn't mean to sound like egotistical about it, but I feel like I know the character. I kind of grew up with Groucho. I loved him for years. I said, I'm just going to try it. I think that my Groucho, I think, is a little more personal than, it's not as flashy. It's not the, you know.
Well, it's not the animal crackers Captain Spaulding Groucho so much as the more reflective.
Yeah, because actually A Life in Review is a really excellent story because it's not all that. It's behind the scenes. It's his life. It's his marriage. It's his women. And, you know, it's really the kind of the things that he suffered through. So I played those parts of his life like Julius Marx, not Groucho, the character. Whereas when I saw Ferrante do it, I felt like he was playing the character in every scene. And I was like, why did he do that? It seemed like he lost the opportunity to play the real man instead of the character role.
He didn't lose an opportunity. I mean, he's been doing that for 25 years on stages all over the world. That's
I know.
I mean, yeah, he made a good choice. No, I'm
not trying to put him down. Yeah. I just felt like it was strange to me that he did it that way.
Well,
but it worked, so who am I to judge?
Do you manipulate your voice to play not-so-up Groucho? How do you sound
a little bit. Yes, I do. And when I do the older Groucho, I do an older Groucho. So, yes, I try to, yes. When I'm doing the character, I'm bigger. You know,
right,
it's like, hooray for Captain Spaulding. You know, I'm the big guy. And when I'm behind stage, I'm a different form of, I mean, I still try to use the voice. I didn't want to be an imitation. I didn't want to be an impersonation of Groucho. I wanted it to be...
I know the words you're thinking of. Well, a tribute, but...
A tribute. You know, I wanted it to be like the real... A personification. Maybe that's
yes,
the
characterization,
word.
Yes, characterization, persona...
Not an impression. I didn't want to be an impressionist of Groucho.
Although, let's face it, the best Groucho ever is Old Senile Groucho by Gilbert Gottfried.
Yes, I've seen that. It's wonderful.
It's magnificent. I mean, come on.
Yes.
Any other comedians that you grew up being really impressed by and said, ooh, maybe one day, long before you went to that contest?
Well, you know, what's funny is what goes around comes around. Bobby Collins, when 1980 or so, I was first going out with my now wife, we went to a comedy club in Huntington, the East Side Comedy Club. And the guy on stage was Bobby Collins, and I never forgot. I was watching him, and I said, you know what? I want to do that someday. He was the guy that kind of got the spark in my head of, I think I could do this. And I even told him that story, and he was like a little, he loved it, but I think he felt a little funny about it. But he was the guy that kind of inspired me. It took me another 10, 11 years to actually do it, but I could think back as him being one of the guys that I saw. Of course, growing up, you know, George Carlin, Robert Klein.
Yes.
Dare I say, Bill Cosby. I grew up with Bill Cosby. It still hurts me that he turned out to be that. But
well, or even look at Louis C.K. and then the stuff. I mean, are all comedians a little bit nuts, even if they're not
dangerous? Yeah, look at Woody Allen. The jury's still out on Woody Allen. But I love Woody Allen. But, you know, I think it's only a matter of time before that, you know, comes to the roost.
As it were. But let me ask in a more happy sort of a way.
Sure.
Who's funnier, Jews or Italians?
Jews or Italians?
Yes.
Oh, Jews, all the way. All the way.
Don't even have to elaborate. I just wanted to ask that. But also, before we let you go, you did a short film a couple of years ago called Suffering in Suburbia.
Suffocating in Suburbia.
Suffocating. I thought it was suffering. See, that's my Jewish take on it right
they
there.
They both work.
Suffocating in Suburbia. Is there more of that? Since, you know, you're doing the stand-up, you're doing but maybe is there a way to get your name out there more to maybe do an iTunes sort of a CD? Are you at that point? A video sort of special? To get to that next step. Do you have an agent?
No, I don't. And it's very, you know, here's the business. I shouldn't say that. I just signed on with a guy who just started up his agency. So maybe I have an agent. I don't know. He hasn't said anything for me yet. But the problem today is it's not like the old days where an agent came into a show, a comedy club, and say, hey, we can build this guy. They don't build comedians anymore. What they do is they say, oh, you got 80 million hits on YouTube? You need an agent. They want you to do all the work, and then they just step in.
But are you at the point, though, where you can maybe start doing videos and more IT?
Well, I do have videos. I've tried a number of times to do a live taping, and it never comes out the way I want it to. So I don't market it. And I probably could. I did have a couple of DVDs that I've sold.
Oh, good.
But nothing that I almost had a record company interested in me, and then he declined to do it. I don't know why. It's a struggle. I probably could try harder. I don't. I struggle with that a lot.
And also this whole idea of a lot of, you know, we were talking before about the ones who go and get sitcoms. That's the thing Bobby Collins never had. When we talk about he hasn't made that. And the only reason he's a comedian's comedian as opposed to somebody who's on everybody's mind or tongue is that he didn't get the Seinfeld, the Kevin James, the sitcom.
Certainly deserves it. I mean, look at, you know what I think it is? I think it's like music. Like, top 40 music is not necessarily the best music. And a lot of the best music never breaks the top 40, you know?
Well, you've done didn't you do a blog about music for a while?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I do. I talk music all the time because I'm a huge music fan. But you know, just because it's popular doesn't mean it's the best. I mean, I like Sebastian Maniscalco, and he's extremely popular. He's probably going to be a billionaire. But I don't think his act is like ridiculously original. He's doing the same stuff that I've seen other Italian comics do. There's nothing.
I've never heard of him.
Any ground.
I honestly, maybe I only follow the Jewish comedians, but Sebastian Maniscalco, this man, I have no idea who this is.
Huge. He sells out like Radio City Music Hall for weeks. He's got DVDs. He's very big. He's a big act.
Huh.
Or like Seinfeld. I love Seinfeld. Love him. I'm a huge Seinfeld fan. He's in my top five. Love the show. I think he's brilliant. But is he really, like, is he doing anything groundbreaking, or is he just telling clever jokes? But yet, look at him, he's a billionaire.
Well, everybody has their, you can, did Henny Youngman do anything groundbreaking? No, but he had a good career. It doesn't necessarily have to be the Sam Kinison who finds a new path, or the Robin Williams who just spins off into something.
Or the George Carlin, or, you know.
Yeah. Well, Carlin did have his own idiom. He really did. He was a special sort of type.
Right. I mean, he was kind of a Lenny Bruce. He branched off of Lenny Bruce. I mean, that was
right.
Who started that. But I think he definitely took it to a new level.
So let me ask you, before we let you go, Stevie GB, what's the most recent joke you've written?
The most recent joke I've written?
Yeah. Or it can be a bit. I know it's tough to put a comedian on the spot and say, tell me a one-liner and be funny about it, and then it's one you haven't tested in front of audiences yet. But what's something that you might be testing out tonight at Theater 3 in Port Jefferson?
At Theater 3 in Port Jefferson? Well, I've been working on this one. My mother-in-law is in her 80s now, and one thing she has that I hope I get to have eventually is she has a whole posse of people that help her out with different things. Like her grandson will come over to open the pickle jar. You know, I'm in charge of her finance stuff. My wife is in charge of her doctor stuff. So it must be nice to have that ability to get to a certain age and just have a whole bunch of people at your disposal that you don't have to pay. I want to get to that point. Again, it's not developed, but I think there's something there.
That is, you need the button on it. You need the something where, you know.
It needs a punchline.
Yeah.
But, you know, I want to have that ability where I can sit behind a big desk and just call people up. Yeah, pickle jaw, come on over.
Yeah, or maybe think of what if 18-year-olds had this when they were going to college. Where's the, where's the person who's going to take my test for me? Who's the person who's going to deal with financial aid? I don't know. That's where I might go with it. You can go a million different directions, of course.
Yeah, I have it. Again, it's kind of uncharted territory, but I like the premise that you get to an age where all of a sudden you have this bevy of people that are just there at your beck and call.
Well,
I like that.
I love being at an age where I get to talk to a bevy of talented, funny people on this radio program of the stream. And among them are the wonderful Stevie GB, whom you can catch tonight, Saturday, August 25th at Theater 3 in Port Jefferson. If for some reason you can't make it, he'll be at Governor's on September 14th in Levittown. He'll be at that Goyish Christian Muslim place, Little Bit of Heaven, in East Northport on September 21st. And he's coming back to Nassau September 22nd. He'll be at the Madison Theater in Rockville Center. So, lots of places to catch Stevie GB. To find out much more about him and follow his progress and his clips and see all the things that he's done, please go to his website, stevieGB.com. And it's Stevie, the letter G, the letter B, .com. And it's funny, it's a great way to remember your name. It is, no offense, much more memorable than Steve Gianturco. But how did they dub you that? It's kind of a surprising story.
Oh, the Stevie GB?
Yeah.
Well, back in the late 70s, in my Dare You to Like Me stage, I was a big punk rock fan. I know, if you looked at me, you'd know it immediately. So I used to go to CBGB's in New York City, the famous club. And I went there so much that somebody coined the phrase, hey, look, there's Stevie GB going to CBGB's. And so it kind of stuck as a nickname. And when I decided to do comedy, I said, I need a nickname. And that's what I came up with.
Well, it's a wonderful name, and you're a very funny man and a delight to talk to. So I wish you many, many more gigs for many, many more years, lots of laughs, and moving to the next level of comedy, Stevie GB, which you have done by appearing on this program. So I thank you so much, and shalom to you.
Shalom to you, Rabbi.